On this week's 51%, we hear from Arianna Huffington on the importance of sleep.
The problem is that we don't prioritize sleep. We put everything ahead of sleep.
A high school student shares a story about her stepfather. A professor offers her views about changes on the Mexican stage. And we have a Women in History profile. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Once there was a way to give back home. Sleep, pretty darling, do not cry. And I will sing a lullaby.
This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. This week, she interviews Arianna Huffington, who is co-founder, president, and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post Media Group, as well as an author. Ufberg does blog for the Huffington Post. Huffington's 15th book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time, on the science, history, and mystery of sleep, was published in April this year and became a New York Times bestseller. She has been named to Time magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential people and the Forbes most powerful women list. Ufberg asks Huffington why this book about sleep was important to write at this time.
So for me, it all started with my own collapse from sleep deprivation and burnout in April 2007, 2 years into building the Huffington Post. And as I came to in my own pool of blood, I had to reevaluate my own life, but also look around and see how many millions of people are burnt out. And that was the beginning of my sleep evangelism by realizing that we're living under a collective delusion that sleep is optional, and that the more important and successful you are, the less time you have for sleep. So it became almost like a badge of honor to brag about being sleep deprivation. So I wanted to write the book to help people become aware of all the latest science around the importance of sleep for our health, our productivity, and our happiness, and to help people shift the culture around this collective delusion.
You know, in this age of this kind of, you know, smartphones and 24/7 work schedules, I'm wondering, as head of a multinational company with hundreds of hardworking employees that you're responsible for, how do you incorporate your values about the importance of sleep within your own corporate culture?
So we started doing that right away. In many different ways. First of all, by making it clear that when you're done with work, you're not expected to be on email or expected to receive texts from your boss, you know, that if we need you, we'll call you. And that is very liberating for people. It makes it possible for people to really disengage from work and reconnect with themselves. We also have nap rooms in the Huffington Post newsroom and in many of our newsrooms around the world. And we encourage people, if they are tired in the middle of the afternoon, to have a nap rather than have a third cinnamon bun or a fourth cup of coffee. And we also have a holiday email policy that deletes emails when people are on vacation and delegates someone else to handle whatever may be needed. And of course, we have a dedicated section on the Huffington Post on sleep and wellness.
I love that. That's something that people should really begin to emulate in the corporate world. I know you have two millennial daughters, such as myself, and I'm wondering what advice you might give your own daughters about sleep.
Well, I'm super happy to say that my daughters have really bought into my sleep evangelism. And in fact, they hold me accountable. When I've been on book tour, they will text me to say, so are you getting your 8 hours, which is what I need? Incidentally, if your listeners are wondering, what do we need? Unless we have a genetic mutation, which means we can do great on 4 or 5 hours, which is about 1% of us, the vast majority of us need 7 to 9 hours. And my sweet spot is very simply 8 hours, but you may be doing great on 7, or you may need 9. Just listen to your body, and if you were waking up without an alarm, that's the sign you slept enough. As you know, we can overeat, but we cannot oversleep unless we are narcoleptic or have a severe depression.
You know, so many of the women that are listening are, you know, women that are balancing all the responsibilities of home and children and long hours of work, and I think they would love to consider the notion of getting 8 hours of sleep. If, you know, that doesn't seem possible, do you have other recommendations how people cope with getting some extra sleep, even if they have a baby and can't necessarily get a straight 8 hours to themselves?
Well, first of all, there will always be times in our life when we have a young child, when we have a sick parent, when we cannot get all the sleep we need during the night. Then the best solution that nature has invented is to try to have a nap as soon as possible, which is the best reset for the day. And even a 20-minute nap has huge restorative powers. But for many of us, the problem is that we don't prioritize sleep. We put everything ahead of sleep, including our work, including our favorite television shows, which we love to binge watch, including answering every email and surfing social media. If you are really incredibly honest, I don't mean you personally, but anybody listening, about what takes precedence over sleep, you'll find out it's almost everything. That's why I've structured the book the way I have. So first, people have to change their minds about the importance of sleep by looking at the science of sleep, by looking at the history of how we got here since the Industrial Revolution started believing that we can eliminate downtime. And then once we change our minds about sleep, it will be much easier to change our habits.
Yeah, I love the part of your book where you actually address the issue of dreams, because I think so often people who are deprived of sleep don't get to have a very active dream life. And I'm wondering, are you an active dreamer? Do you write down your dreams? Do you find dreams helpful in making you, you know, help you make decisions, sorting out your life story?
Oh, absolutely. I love them in every possible way. First of all, now before I go to sleep, I'm really curious about what is my dream life going to be like tonight? What's going to be in the movies tonight? And also, sometimes they're incredibly insightful, and sometimes they're simply processing things that have not been fully emotionally processed during the day.
It is so great that you've taken such a strong evangelical stand on sleep. It's something I believe is so important for our health and well-being, and I know you mentioned it in your first book, Thrive, and now that you've dedicated an entire book to it, I want to thank you for inspiring others to get a little more shut eye. You know, if people have questions about, particularly for you, is there some way that people can reach you directly?
Of course, they can email me directly, Ariana, with one R and two N's, at HuffingtonPost.com. They can go to ArianaHuffington.com for any information on the book, shows I've done, including yours, which we're going to post there. And let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you so much. Ariana Huffington with her new book, The Sleep Revolution, Transforming Your Life One Night at a Time. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
In honor of Father's Day, we bring you Christina Treviso's story of love and loss at a time when she was a high school student in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Treviso's story is from the Youth Media Project.
Back when I was a child, before life removed all the innocence, my father would lift me high and dance with my mother and me, and then
I remember the first time I saw my stepdad. Always smiling, funny, not so tall. He had a dimple on his chin. He had deep brown eyes. His hair was short and straight, and with gray hairs here and there. He had a soothing aroma. It was a fresh scent that he carried. The type of scent that was truly unique. Only he had that about him. I knew for sure that he loved my mom, and also I knew he loved my brother and I. I was 6 years old when I first saw him. And since that first day, he started giving me all the love with no exceptions. Padre no es el que engendra, sino el que cría. We went to live to Chihuahua, just my mom, my dad, and I. My brother didn't come with us. He wanted to stay with my grandparents. We lived in a house in Chihuahua for almost a year, the best year of my life. I remember we'd go to the park every night and eat those deliciosos elotes. It was a corn on a cob smothered with mayo, sprinkled with red chili powder, parmesan cheese, just a little bit of lime juice, and a pinch of salt. Mmm, qué rico. I will be very messy eating them. But when I turn up to see my dad, he will be very careful and never smother his face. Those were the best days of happiness. Then my mom and dad decided to go to the United States and leave us in Mexico in order to give me and my brother a better life. I couldn't live without them. I missed them so much. So when my mom offered to take us with her, era una oferta que no podía rechazar. However, my brother stayed with my grandparents. That was 2 years after they left. When I came here, everything was so amazing. I saw things I never seen in my town. Here, they had buildings, nice cars, and everybody drove. Now I wore new clothes more often, and I was with my parents. That was the most important thing. They were the best parents ever. They gave all the love that our little girl needs. Everything was going so well in our new life. Good moments happened here, and also I got to know my two stepsisters that also were wonderful people. We have good memories of everything that we did together. My life was like the perfect life for a little girl. But not everything was so perfect. That perfection went away when my dad got sick and was in the hospital. At the point, I felt horrible because I saw my dad in that bed and not able to help him. It was a horrible experience, looking at my dad and see all those machines next to him. My dad was in rehabilitation for 1 month because of the stroke he had. Half of his body was paralyzed. He had therapy to get some of his movement back. My mother practically lived in the hospital. She never left his side. My daddy missed my middle school graduation. After graduation, I went to the hospital to show him my diplomas. He cried, hugged me, and told me how proud he was of me. On June 1st, my dad got out of the hospital. We thought that the worst part was over, but we were wrong. In June 29th, my dad suffered a second stroke. He was only in the hospital for 3 days. My dad couldn't resist the pain anymore. Then we received the bad news from the doctor.
We did everything.
My dad was gone. He passed away. I didn't believe what the doctor was telling us. That person that gave me all the love and a good education was gone. That was the worst moment of my life. I had a knot on my throat. My legs were shaking. I couldn't talk. My eyes were filled with tears. It seemed so unreal. I felt like the whole world just went down that day. I was 13 years old when my dad passed away. He didn't make it to my quinceañera party. I wished that my dad could be able to be there and dance that traditional waltz with me. It wasn't the same without him.
Cuando el mundo se para y te observa girar, es tiempo para...
I know that my dad is gone, but he's always in my heart. I know that he's here with me, giving me all the love he used to give me when he was alive. Papa, Usted fue el mejor padre del mundo. Le doy gracias a la vida por haberlo puesto en mi camino. Gracias por todo el amor que me dio. Lo quiero con todo mi corazón y lo extraño mucho.
At the end, Treviso says he was the best dad in the world, that she is thankful that he was put in her path. She says she loves him with all her heart and misses him very much. Just across the southern border, something interesting is happening on stage, and one scholar says that the theater in Mexico has become a venue for addressing the shadows in the country's history. Lilia Fukin has the story.
In the year 2012, over 12,000 Mexicans died in gang and drug-related violence. And that same year, a play irreverently called The Narco Does Business with God opened in Mexican theaters.
It was such a huge hit. Of course, the title in and of itself is going to be a draw because everybody wants to know how the narco is doing business with God.
This is Jackie Bixler, a Spanish professor at Virginia Tech. She specializes in Latin American theater, Mexican theater in particular. And she says that this play, The Narco Does Business with God, is basically about the whole moral state of Mexico right now.
And how difficult it is to distinguish the good from the bad, or the narco from the politician. I mean, people honestly don't know anymore when somebody moves into the neighborhood, is this a good guy or is this a bad guy? Because there's such a level of collusion among the politicians and the narcos. And so, you know, it just really called into question, who are we?
The playwright, Sabina Berman, wrote the dark comedy to bring the problematic moral double standard into the social conversation. It might be hard to believe that someone can write funny plays about drug violence.
But sometimes there is humor. It's a very black form of humor. But I find that audiences respond better to that than if they go to see a play where there's no laughter.
Jackie says, for example, that a serious play about somebody being kidnapped strikes a chord with many people in the audience.
Or another topic that's been very, very commonly treated is the murder of all the women in Mexico, in northern Mexico, along the border, for example, in Ciudad Juarez. I mean, thousands and thousands of women have been killed up there.
Contemporary Mexican theater also started to dig into the country's history.
The only problem is that there's two kinds of history in Mexico. There's what we call official history and unofficial history. Official history is what the government supports and publishes. And unofficial history is the history that you have to often go out and talk to people in small towns about, meaning that's the history that doesn't get published.
What theater can do, Jackie says, is go back and revisit famous events and people.
Sometimes they go and they uncover all new documents and things that have been buried for years, and they bring out another whole side of the character. And so the theater is a way of reopening the door on history.
Jackie says theater is looking under the table.
Hayden White, who's a theorist, says that history, historiography, is like a table. And when you look at a table, we only see the tabletop, right? Nonetheless, we're always conscious that there's an underneath part. There's an underside to the table, but we never go looking to see what's there.
So whether a play is written from an indigenous Aztec point of view or that of a modern-day narco, Mexico's theater scene is bringing the dark side of its story into the spotlight. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fukin.
And now we turn to the Women in History stage, where Henrietta Swan Leavitt is the star in a profile from Gilles Malkin.
There was a time in the not very distant past in which humans were unaware of our planets and our sun's positions in our own galaxy and the contents of the universe beyond. It was thanks to the tireless efforts and original thinking of one woman and the breakthrough she produced that a major update of our conception of the universe became possible. By producing the means to establish the distance of certain stars, simple an idea as that may seem, a clearer picture of the proportions of the heavens and our place in them was achieved. Henrietta Swan Leavitt was born on July 4, 1868, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. She was a descendant of the English Puritan Deacon John Leavitt of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Her father was a preacher, and Henrietta was a serious and devoted student. She attended Oberlin and Radcliffe Colleges, and eventually took employment at the Harvard College Observatory under Edward Pickering. The task given to her consisted of very mundane work, that of examining hundreds of photographic plates of the night sky and cataloging her observations on the characteristics of their light. Before Leavitt's time, the method of measuring the distance to the stars consisted of noting their positions relative to a particular spot on the Earth 6 months apart, and then using the angle created by the two to arrive at the actual position. But the farther away a star was, the less accurate this method could be. Leavitt began focusing on certain stars of variable luminosity called Cepheids. She found that not only some of these stars pulsated on a steady and consistent basis, but that there was a definite and predictable relationship between the period of time between the pulsations and the star's brightness. Then, by measuring how bright or dim a star was, a new calibration was created that could now be used as an accurate means to calculate the star's distance from us. This gave astronomer Edwin Hubble and others the key with which to arrive at more accurate observations than before, and to do away with former erroneous ideas. For example, it was used to remove the Sun from the center of the Milky Way, to remove the Milky Way from the center of the universe, and to establish Hubble's law, which states that the universe is expanding. Our view of the universe was forever changed. Leavitt's work provided the proof that these far-off stars were actually in other galaxies and were not, as was thought before, simply other stars on the periphery of our own Milky Way. As part of her work, Leavitt developed and refined the logarithmic scale used by Harvard Observatory on the brightness and classification of stars, and she became head of photographic photometry at the college. But because she was a woman, Leavitt was not allowed access to the great telescopes of the day, such as the 100-inch Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson, with which she might have made these discoveries and others herself. Even the paper in which she published her findings in 1912 had to be attributed to her boss at Harvard, Edward Pickering. Henrietta Swan Leavitt was, by accounts from those who knew her, just as serious and devoted about life as she was about her work. She was a joyous person and totally committed to helping her family and friends no matter what the issue might be. She became deaf at an early age due to an illness, but she remained loyal to her religion, her principles of worth, and willingness to deal with life's hardships, including that of being relegated to second-class citizenship for her gender, notwithstanding the brilliance of her work. Henrietta Swan Leavitt died of cancer at the age of 53 in 1921. Her name was proposed by the Swedish Academy of Sciences for a Nobel Prize in Physics in 1926, unaware that she had died by then, and this honor is not awarded posthumously. One of her colleagues stated in her obituary that she had the happy faculty of appreciating all that was worthy and lovable in others, and was possessed of a nature so full of sunshine that to her all of life became beautiful and full of meaning. A true star of light herself. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Writer, composer, and actor Gilles Malkin is a resident of the Catskills region of New York.
How would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar? And be better off than you are? Or would you rather be a pig? Hey!
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1403.